Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin. With a clamour of bells that set the swallows soaring, the festival of summer came to the city Omelas, bright towered by the sea. The rigging of the boats in the harbour sparkled with flags. In the streets between the houses with red roofs and painted walls, between old moss-grown gardens and under avenues of trees, past great parks and public buildings, processions moved. Some were decorous, old people in long, stiff robes of mauve and grey, grave master workmen, quiet, merry women carrying their babies and chatting as they walked. In other streets the music beat faster, a shimmering of gong and tambourine, and the people went dancing. The procession was a dance. Children dodged in and out, their high calls rising like the swallows crossing flights over the music and the singing. All the processions wound towards the north side of the city, where on the great water meadow, called the Green Fields, boys and girls naked in the bright air, with mud-stained feet and ankles and long, lithe arms, exercised their restive horses before the race. The horses wore no gear at all but a halter without a bit. Their manes were braided with streamers of silver, gold, and green. They flared their nostrils and pranced and boasted to one another. They were vastly excited, the horse being the only animal who has adopted our ceremonies as his own. Far off to the north and west, the mountains stood up half encircling Omelas on her bay. The air of morning was so clear that the snow was still crowning the 18 peaks, burned with white gold fire across the miles of sunlit air, under the dark blue of the sky. There was just enough wind to make the banners that marked the racecourse snap and flutter now and then. In the silence of the broad green meadows, one could hear the music winding through the city streets, farther and nearer and ever approaching, a cheerful faint sweetness of the air that from time to time trembled and gathered together and broke out into the great joyous clanging of the bells. Joyous. How is one to tell about joy? How to describe the citizens of Omelas? They were not simple folk, you see, though they were happy, but we do not say the words of cheer much anymore. All smiles have become archaic. Given a description such as this, one tends to make certain assumptions. Given a description such as this, one tends to look next for the king, mounted on a splendid stallion and surrounded by his noble knights, or perhaps in a golden litter, borne by great-muscled slaves. But there was no king. They did not use swords or keep slaves. They were not barbarians. I do not know the rules and laws of their society, but I suspect they were singularly few. As they did without monarchy and slavery, so they also got on without the stock exchange, the advertisement, the secret police, and the bomb. Yet I repeat that these were not simple folk, not dulcet shepherds, noble savages, bland utopians. They were not less complex than us. The trouble is that we have a bad habit, encouraged by pedants and sophisticates, of considering happiness as something rather stupid. Only pain is intellectual, only evil interesting. This is the treason of the artist, a refusal to admit the banality of evil and the terrible boredom of pain. If you can't lick him, join him. If it hurts, repeat it. But to praise despair is to condemn delight. To embrace violence is to lose hold of everything else. We have almost lost hold. We can no longer describe a happy man nor make any celebration of joy. How can I tell you about the people of Omelas? They were not naive and happy children, though their lives were in fact happy. They were mature, intelligent, passionate adults, whose lives were not wretched. Oh, miracle! But I wish I could describe it better. I wish I could convince you. Omelas sounds, in my words, like a city in a fairy tale, long ago and far away, once upon a time. Perhaps it would be best if you imagined it as your own fancy bids, assuming it will rise to the occasion, for certainly I cannot suit you all. For instance, how about technology? I think there would be no cars or helicopters in and above the streets. This follows from the fact that the people of Omelas are happy people. Happiness is based on a just discrimination of what is necessary, what is neither necessary nor destructive, and what is destructive. In the middle category, however, that of the unnecessary but undestructive, that of comfort, luxury, exuberance, etc., they could perfectly well have central heating, subway trains, washing machines, and all kinds of marvellous devices not yet invented here. Floating light sources, fuelless power, a cure for the common cold. Or they could have none of that. It doesn't matter. As you like it. I incline to think that the people from towns up and down the coast have been coming into Omelas during the last days before festival on very fast little trains and double-decked trams, and that the train station of Omelas is actually the handsomest building in town, though plainer than the magnificent farmer's market. But even granted trains, I fear that Omelas so far strikes some of you as goody-goody. Smiles, bells, parades, horses. Blech. If so, please add an orgy, if an orgy would help. Don't hesitate. Let us not, however, have temples, from which issue beautiful nude priests and priestesses, already half in ecstasy and ready to copulate with any man or woman, lover or stranger, who desires union with the deep godhead of the blood. Although that was my first idea. But really it would be better not to have any temples in Omelas. At least, not manned temples. Religion? Yes. Clergy? No. Surely the beautiful nudes can just wander about, offering themselves like divine souffles to the hunger of the needy and the rapture of the flesh. Let them join the processions. Let tambourines be struck above the copulations, and the glory of desire be proclaimed upon the gongs, and, a not unimportant point, let the offspring of these delightful rituals be beloved and looked after by all. One thing I know there is none of in Omelas is guilt. But what else should there be? I thought at first there were not drugs, but that is puritanical. For those who like it, the faint insistent sweetness of druze may perfume the ways of the city. Druze, which first brings a great lightness and brilliance to the mind and limbs, and then after some hours a dreamy languor, and wonderful visions at last, of the very arcana and inmost secrets of the universe, as well as exciting the pleasure of sex beyond belief. And it is not habit-forming. For more modest tastes, I think there ought to be beer. What else? What else belongs in the joyous city? The sense of victory, surely. The celebration of courage. But as we did without clergy, let us do without soldiers. The joy built upon successful slaughter is not the right kind of joy. It will not do. It is fearful and it is trivial. A boundless and generous contentment, a magnanimous triumph felt not against some outer enemy, but in communion with the finest and the fairest in the souls of all men everywhere, and the splendour of the world's summer. This is what swells the hearts of the people of Omelas. and the victory they celebrate is that of life. I really don't think many of them need to take druze. Most of the procession have reached the green fields by now. A marvellous smell of cooking goes forth from the red and blue tents of the provisioners. The faces of small children are amiably sticky. In the benign grey beard of a man, a couple of crumbs of rich pastry are entangled. The youths and girls have mounted their horses and are beginning to group around the starting line of the course. An old woman, small, fat and laughing, is passing out flowers from a basket, and tall young men wear her flowers in their shining hair. A child of 9 or 10 sits at the edge of the crowd, alone, playing on a wooden flute. People pause to listen, and they smile, but they do not speak to him, for he never ceases playing, and never sees them, his dark eyes wholly wrapped in the sweet, thin magic of the tune. He finishes, and slowly lowers his hands, holding the wooden flute. As if that little private silence were the signal, all at once a trumpet sounds from the pavilion, near the starting line, imperious, melancholy, piercing. The horses rear on their slender legs, and some of them neigh in answer. Sober-faced, the young riders stroke the horses' necks and soothe them, whispering, "Quiet, quiet there, my beauty, my hope." They begin to form in rank along the starting line. The crowds along the racecourse are like a field of grass and flowers in the wind. The festival of summer has begun. Do you believe? Do you accept the festival? The city? The joy? No? Then let me describe one more thing. In a basement under one of the beautiful public buildings of Omelas, or perhaps in the cellar of one of the spacious private homes, there is a room. It has one locked door and no window. A little light seeps in dustily between cracks in the boards, second hand from a cobwebbed window somewhere across the cellar. In one corner of the little room, a couple of mops with stiff, clotted, foul-smelling heads stand near a rusty bucket. The floor is dirt, a little damp to the touch, as cellar dirt usually is. The room is about 3 paces long and 2 wide, a mere broom closet or disused tool room. In the room, a child is sitting. It could be a boy or a girl. It looks about 6, but actually is nearly 10. It is feeble-minded. Perhaps it was born defective, or perhaps it has become imbecile through fear, malnutrition, and neglect. It picks its nose and occasionally fumbles vaguely with its toes or genitals, as it sits hunched in the corner, farthest from the bucket and the 2 mops. It is afraid of the mops. It finds them horrible. It shuts its eyes, but it knows the mops are still standing there, and the door is locked, and nobody will come. The door is always locked, and nobody ever comes. Except that sometimes, the child has no understanding of time or interval, sometimes the door rattles terribly and opens, and a person or several people are there. One of them may come in and kick the child to make it stand up. The others never come close, but peer in at it with frightened, disgusted eyes. The food bowl and the water jug are hastily filled. The door is locked. The eyes disappear. The people at the door never say anything. But the child, who has not always lived in the tool room, and can remember sunlight and its mother's voice, sometimes speaks. "I will be good," it says. "Please let me out. I will be good." They never answer. The child used to scream for help at night and cry a good deal, but now it only makes a kind of whining. "Ha! Ha!" And it speaks less and less often. It is so thin that there are no calves to its legs. Its belly protrudes. It lives on a half bowl of cornmeal and grease a day. It is naked. Its buttocks and thighs are a mass of festered sores, as it sits on its own excrement continually. They all know it is there, the people of Omelas. Some of them have come to see it. Others are content merely to know it is there. They all know that it has to be there. Some of them understand why, and some do not. But they all understand that their happiness, the beauty of their city, the tenderness of their friendships, the health of their children, the wisdom of their scholars, the skill of their makers, even the abundance of their harvest and the kindly weathers of their skies, depend wholly on this child's abominable misery. This is usually explained to children when they are between 8 and 12, whenever they seem capable of understanding. And most of those who come to see the child are young people, though often enough an adult comes, or comes back, to see the child. No matter how well the matter has been explained to them, these young spectators are always shocked and sickened at the sight. They feel disgust, which they had thought themselves superior to. They feel anger, outrage, impotence, despite all the explanations. They would like to do something for the child, but there is nothing they can do. If the child were brought up into the sunlight, out of that vile place, if it were cleaned and fed and comforted, that would be a good thing indeed. But if it were done, in that day and hour, all the prosperity and beauty and delight of Omelas would wither and be destroyed. Those are the terms. To exchange all the goodness and grace of every life in Omelas for that single small improvement, to throw away the happiness of thousands for the chance of the happiness of one, that would be to let guilt within the walls indeed. The terms are strict and absolute. There may not even be a kind word spoken to the child. Often the young people go home in tears, or in a tearless rage, when they have seen the child and faced this terrible paradox. They may brood over it for weeks or years, but as time goes on, they begin to realize that even if the child could be released, it would not get much good of its freedom. A little vague pleasure of warmth and food, no doubt, but little more. It is too degraded and imbecile to know any real joy. It has been afraid too long to ever be free of fear. Its habits are too uncouth for it to respond to humane treatment. Indeed, after so long, it would probably be wretched without the walls about it to protect it, and darkness for its eyes, and its own excrement to sit in. Their tears at the bitter injustice dry when they begin to perceive the terrible justice of reality, and to accept it. Yet it is their tears and anger, the trying of their generosity, and the acceptance of their helplessness, which are perhaps the true source of the splendor of their lives. Theirs is no vapid, irresponsible happiness. They know that they, like the child, are not free. They know compassion. It is the existence of the child and their knowledge of its existence that makes possible the nobility of their architecture, the poignancy of their music, the profundity of their science. It is because of the child that they are so gentle with children. They know that if the wretched one were not there sniveling in the dark, the other one, the flute player, could make no joyful music as the young riders line up in their beauty for the race in the sunlight of the first morning of summer. Now, do you believe in them? Are they not more credible? But there is one more thing to tell, and this is quite incredible. At times, one of the adolescent girls or boys who goes to see the child does not go home to weep or rage, does not, in fact, go home at all. Sometimes also a man or woman, much older, falls silent for a day or two and then leaves home. These people go out into the street and walk down the street alone. They keep walking, and walk straight out of the city of Omelas, through the beautiful gates. They keep walking across the farmlands of Omelas. Each one goes alone, youth or girl, man or woman. Night falls, the traveller must pass down the village streets, between the houses with the yellow-lit windows, and on out into the darkness of the fields. Each alone, they go west or north, toward the mountains. They go on. They leave Omelas. They walk ahead into the darkness and they do not come back. The place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the City of Happiness. I cannot describe it at all. It is possible that it does not exist. But they seem to know where they are going. The ones who walk away from Omelas.
And that was The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. And I am joined by Neil Poole to talk about this. It's been a while, Pooley. Great to have you back in the house to talk about a really interesting one, man. First of all, as it's been a while, how have you been?
Much better than the child in this story, Trev. You'll be glad to know. Yes. Excellent yes. story. Great one for us to do again. One I've been really excited to do. So, yeah, I'm good. I'm as happy as the inhabitants of Omelas or Omelas, and ready to crack on.
It is an interesting one, this. And I hope that as people were listening, they were coming to the same ideas that you and I were as we were reading it and thinking about this as a possibility, because this brought us right back to the origins of the great stories, episode number one and the lottery, because this is another kind of twisted moral problematic quandary story. What would you do? And then we had a slightly less problematic one in the form of the bet, but again, very engaging for, I think, the listeners of this podcast to have a story which causes them to ask questions. Now, Pooley, this one asks you endless questions about yourself, your take on morality, about the author, about the speaker in the story and their take on morality, about the people of Omelas, the people who walk away from Omelas. It's endless. You've got endless questions at the end of this. I think that's a good thing, because you don't feel like you can nail this down as, well, that's a nasty little story, or I don't like what he or she is saying there. It's deliberately done by the author, I think, at times as well, made sort of not necessarily vague, but deliberately confusing, so that you are sort of forced to engage in this moral conundrum. But back to the idea of it being like the lottery, it just struck me, man. You know, you've got the kind of the whole idea of summer and harvest festivals and the kind of pagan buzz of it and the happiness of the community being dependent on the horror for one. It's remarkable. I mean, in that terms, in the terms of a scapegoat as well, you've got a religion or an ideology or a faith or a superstition, all these kind of concepts coming back around to us full circle in this episode that we had to engage with really right from the start.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like you said, it repeats what the lottery does in terms of it's the idea of, is it okay to sacrifice one person for the many and then for the continued happiness and contentment for another year in the case of the lottery for those people? But it does have a normal narrative structure, and there is a beginning, middle and an end. I was going to come to you and say, oh, this is completely different. There isn't a beginning, a middle and an end. I think there is a beginning and a middle and an end, but between that beginning, middle and end, and between the way those three parts are actually presented, this is all over the shop. And I think that this asks the reader or the listener to work a lot harder than, say, for example, the lottery or the bet does. Because with those stories, then it's at the end you think, oh, what would I do? While with this, you think at the end, what would I do? But all the way through it, you're thinking, what exactly is going on? What exactly is this story trying to tell me? And also, I think how this is a little bit different, and not saying it's better than a lottery, but I think it's more complex and therefore does complex mean more interesting. But in the lottery, from recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong, Trev, we look at it very much from the outside looking in, and we see their actions and we can read some things into the characters and how they're sort of feeling and what have you. But in this, you get, because it's much more fluid and it goes from first person narrative to one point, and then it goes actually to a lot of it's in the second person narrative where it's talking to us. It's going all over the shop, talking about one thing, 1 minute, breaks down the fourth wall quite a lot. This actually puts us in the minds of the people of the town as well, and how they rationalize the fact that they live with this child being abused and neglected in captivity, which I don't think we get in the lottery too much in terms of how they rationalize it to themselves. And this sort of puts us inside the brain and the minds of the people of how are we calling it? Omalas or Omalas?
Omalas, yeah.
Omalas. Yeah, Omalas. So, yeah, it's a similar story. What would you do? One person sacrificed for the many. But the way in which it tells that story and the complexity with which it's done and the work that it asks from you as a listener or reader, I think is very different.
Very different. And I think if you're right, it's a different level of expectation. There's a different sort of level of depth, I think, to this one. You could say they both ask profound questions. This one, because, like you say, of how the problem is presented through the use of the narrative voice, through the use of insight for the reader as to how people might be actually feeling, it becomes a far more difficult prospect and I think far more unsettling read as a result. Obviously, on a simplistic level, you know, you're going to have this very visceral reaction to it and to the suffering of the child. But the story demands more from you than just that. You know, it's that's not enough in and of itself, because when you follow that through, that doesn't solve the scenario or doesn't answer the question that's being asked. So it's a very, very interesting one. But before we get into it, and I do want to give folks a little bit about the origins of Ursula K. Le Guin's story and some interesting background, at least I think, that helps frame up the discussion for us in a while. I know you wanted to tell me something about a trolley.
When you shared this story with me, you know what, like the story does, let's break down the fourth wall of the great story. So what happens is me and Trev have this this very unique app called WhatsApp, right?
And you may not have heard of it, listener.
Yeah, it's a small cottage industry, and essentially Trev will send me a link to a story and say, what do you think of that? Should we do it next? And then I invariably go, yeah, let's do that, that's good, because Trev always picks great questions. Everyone, not great questions, Trev always picks great stories. So I think 99 times out of 100, yeah, let's do that one. And then the first thing that came to mind when you sent me this story, Trev, was there's a philosophical problem called the trolley problem. So I think they do this in, you know, whether it's philosophy degrees or even at a lower level. And this is very much a philosophical story as well, where it's asking the reader, oh, is the way in which the society acts right? Does it have to act in this way? Lots of moral conundrums is essentially it. So the trolley problem isn't exactly the same as this, but it's got the same basic premise. And you know how I can ramble on, Trev? So what I've actually done is I've just wrote it down in simple sentences for myself, so I don't make this longer than it needs to be. Nice. or any more confusing, because I would totally lose track of this. Okay, so
okay,
this is the philosophical trolley problem. By the way, a trolley, we were talking a train. Okay, so Trev, and by the way, I want you to answer this as well. I want to tell you what would you do? Okay. So Trevor, you're at a train station at the platform and you see a train coming down the track and it's about to kill five people who are tied to the track. But you're standing next to a lever. If you pull it, you can redirect the train down another track, where it will kill one person. So if it goes down this other track, there's one person who's tied to that one. So your choices are, do you do nothing and allow five people to be killed? Or do you directly intervene and in doing so cause the death of one person? So you've got a choice there. Do nothing and let five people be killed. And then you could legitimately say, oh, that was nothing to do with me, or was it? Okay. Or pull a lever and then directly yourself be responsible for the death of one person, but you save those other five. So loads of things going on about is five lives worth more than one? Your level of intervention is not intervening an intervention in and of itself. So this came to mind because this is essentially what this story is about, is do you sacrifice one life for the sake of more lives? though, in obviously this story, the other people aren't being killed, they're just living happily. So this was exactly the first thing that came to mind. So I think that is very much like the story. But go on, Trev, what would you do? Would you pull a lever and kill one, or leave it and let five get killed?
You know what? I can't be flippant about this. I'm not trying to be flippant about this. But the first time I thought about this, I thought exactly the same as the last time, most recent time. And I was presented with this idea ages ago, and I'd forgotten about it till you reintroduced me to the idea in a chat we had. And you kind of put your finger on the key issue here. Is doing nothing actually an action in and of itself? Is not intervening actually an action in and of itself? And so it becomes, what's more morally justifiable to you? Would it be to intervene with X result, or not intervene, which is in itself an action, with Y result? And is there a certain level of moral cowardice actually in not intervening and taking on yourself the burden of making that decision? So, you know, obviously I like to think that I would do the thing that would result in less damage, and I think that is the morally justifiable position to take. But you know, there's no right answer here. That's the thing. Well, maybe there is, but purely from an immediate answer, and like I say, it very much echoes my initial thought as well, where you go with the least carnage, and doing nothing is actually an action in and of itself. I mean, does that make sense to you, or have I overcomplicated that?
Yeah, totally. And I think you're right in saying there is no right or wrong answer, and that is why this story reminds me of the trolley problem, in terms of you can think it over and over again and you start looking at all of the different facets of it. And I think lots of different people would have different views on what the people in that town do, and also for the people who stay and the people that leave. And there's a saying, isn't there, about like you can make a range of reasonable decisions, and within that spectrum of decisions they can all be quite different, but you could argue something for it to present it as being reasonable, and it would be a, you know, an appropriate decision to make. And I think with the trolley problem and with a lot of what goes on in this story, it doesn't tie together nicely, and you can, you know, you can go lots of different ways on it, and lots of people would have a very different point of view. So again, as I said, that open-endedness and that difficulty is why this story reminded me of that problem. And I think that's what this story is trying to be. It's trying to be a philosophical problem put into a narrative that is then trying to make the reader think. And it's allegoric and relate this to other parts of life and society in the world, in the way in which we knowingly accept bad things going on to allow us to have our own happiness and luxuries. So yeah, well, oh, it's big. We could do this for hours, Trev. This is five pint territory, this, I'm telling you.
It is five pint territory. And you're right, it's an enormous topic. And I'm so glad you went there with that initial thing, because it's a more simplified version of the bigger question that we're going to be asking all the way through this. And you know, that coming back to that concept of inaction, there's that Edmund Burke quote, isn't it, that the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. And I think that puts its finger on it right there. And so for that reason, at the moment, I'm very much leaning towards that answer that I gave, and that maybe there is a right answer. But we'll come around to this, because this is, as you say, it's far too complex a philosophical conundrum to just say here's right and here's wrong.
Yeah, and I don't want to tread on the Trev agenda toes here, but just because you just said then, do you think these people who walk, I was going to say at the end, we just find out at the end that they walk, but do you think the people who walk away from the town, do you think they're doing nothing, or do you think they're doing something? Do you get what I mean?
Oh, you see, that's the whole, this is the moral philosophy in a nutshell. They've done, what would be the technical term? Fuck all. They walked away from the situation. You know, they're at the train in the train station, and they just go, oh, I can't. They're just, that's them. Whereas the ones that are ignoring it, at least they've made a call, right? They've made a call, and you may inherently disagree with it to your very bones. But actually, I don't think there's anything heroic. Yeah, this is like kind of getting off the fence a bit early, but I don't think there's anything heroic about the ones who are walking away. I fully understand the concept of the decision that they're making. They can't deal with it. And I think that, you know, they have a conscience that's stronger than the people who remain. but they don't intervene. Maybe they don't intervene because they know that it would create the downfall of their family and friends and their joy and their happiness. So maybe there is a real positive to their actions. But look, it's a question that we'll keep coming back to.
I would say that essentially the people who stay and the people do the same thing and have the same solution. There's just a slight variation on it in terms of the people who stay mentally and intellectually and emotionally close off the problem by rationalizing in their heads and move away from the problem in that way. The people who leave the town, can't mentally, emotionally, intelligently move away from the problem. So they just move themselves away from it physically. So I think essentially what they're both doing is just distancing themselves from this trapped kid, but in two different ways, essentially, is what they're both doing. And I don't think there's that much difference between the people who leave and the people who stay. Except
that the people who walk away no longer benefit from the misery of the child. Yes, they don't intervene, but they're no longer taking their happiness and joy from the fact that the child suffers. This stupid, you know, essential part of this situation that's at the heart of it. So
to play devil's advocate, are they then just making themselves martyrs? And in making themselves martyrs, is there a fine line between when you make yourself a martyr, is it just an act of egocentric selfishness, really, in terms of I now feel better because I feel I've sacrificed something? So essentially, you're still like looking after your own well-being. I don't know.
This is is Mother Teresa actually just selfish because she enjoys giving of herself argument? And it's valid. I get it. So, you know, and again, this is what I love about this, right? You can twist yourself in knots with the way you approach it. And we're just going to try and be, both myself and Neil are going to try to be as intellectually and emotionally honest as we can having this chat, because we haven't prepped it. We don't know where each other stands on it. And it's just very, very interesting to talk it out with you. And look, you're talking in Ursula K. Le Guin, of someone of real standing in literature in general, but specifically in this kind of area and the area of science fiction, particularly speculative fiction, that kind of thing. She did write her own utopian novel, and I want to come back to the idea of utopia later on. That's one of my topics. Because, I mean, that's very much, you have to engage with that idea here, I think, with this one. This was written in 1973, the year of my birth. And that's relevant for one reason, Pooley. I'm just going to throw something in here to start because I know I won't come back to it. And it's relevant because 10 years before, there was a philosopher called Hannah Arendt. And Hannah Arendt was writing about the Adolf Eichmann, the Nazi war criminal, his trial. He was basically the operative responsible for the transportation of millions of Jews and others to various concentration camps. He was like the central administrator type of this. And Arendt was startled by this guy, who she found just to be kind of a bland, boring bureaucrat who, in her words, was neither particularly perverted nor sadistic, but terrifyingly normal. And she coined the phrase, the banality of evil, back in 1963. And Ursula K. Le Guin very noticeably uses that phrase, the banality of evil. And this is going towards the thing that we're talking about here with this. So I just want people to have that in their head, the idea of the ordinariness of evil. And this, again, comes back to the notion of choosing to do nothing, or choosing the easy path, or choosing the path that of least resistance, because, you know, you can close your mind off to the suffering of people. Like Eichmann, the concept of Eichmann is just some bureaucrat doing a job. Now, listen, that in and of itself is a massively challenging idea, and I'm not sure I agree with any of it, but I do understand the banality of evil in a bigger scale. It could be argued that we've seen that over many, many centuries and in recent decades as well around the world. So it's a very, very interesting concept. I just wanted to flag that up in terms of situating the story. So the story comes out in 73. This quote originated in 63 with Hannah Arendt, the philosopher. And just to get into a little bit of the origin of story, where it came from. Okay, so there's this like story about the background where Le Guin was driving away from Salem, Oregon. It was just like Salem, comma, O. And she sees this in the rearview mirror and she thinks, okay, well, that's a cool name. And somebody said, you know, where do you get your ideas from, Miss Le Guin? And she says famously, well, from forgetting Dostoevsky and reading road signs backwards, naturally, what else? She also says, so we've got, there's two things. She also says that the central idea of this, what she calls psychomyth, is the scapegoat. And she says that this scapegoat turns up in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. And several people have asked me, rather suspiciously, she says, why I gave the credit to, here's our extra influencer, William James. But the fact is, I haven't been able to reread Dostoevsky, much as I loved him since I was 25, and I'd simply forgotten he used the idea. But when I met the idea, in James's The Moral Philosopher and the Moral Life, it was with a shock of recognition. So we've got two influences there in terms of this philosopher, William James. I'm going to read you a quote from him. And then I had just recently read The Brothers Karamazov. It's a stunning piece of work. I know Dostoevsky's not for everybody. I couldn't recommend it more. I've heard him described to me recently by a fellow that I talked to on Twitter as a terrible moralist. And he meant terrible as in a, you know, pain in the arse. And I think you could absolutely make that argument about Dostoevsky. But, you know, these are the type of people who give you your moral philosophy problems. Here's the quote from William James in his book, The Moral Philosopher and the Moral Life. Or if the hypothesis were offered us of a world in which Messrs. Fourier and Bellamy, and Morris, they are three writers who wrote them about utopia. So I'll go again. If the hypothesis were offered us of a world in which Messrs. Fourier and Bellamy's and Morris's utopias should all be outdone, and millions kept permanently happy on the one simple condition that a certain lost soul on the far off edge of things should lead a life of lonely torture, well, what except a skeptical and independent sort of emotion can it be which would make us immediately feel, even though an impulse arose within us to clutch at the happiness so offered, how hideous a thing would be its enjoyment when deliberately accepted as the fruit of such a bargain. I think we all want to think that we would think that way. We'd go, I see the bigger picture here and everyone be happy, but no, I can't accept it. Not if it means one person suffering, right? That's the heroic concept that we all think that we would cling on to in real life. And I want to give you a quote from The Brothers Karamazov, which she acknowledged as a direct influence, again, this idea of the scapegoat. And in this, Ivan Karamazov is describing horrible abuse of children that's happened, you know, punishments and just depraved behavior towards them, being locked up, treated horribly. Again, the whole excrement thing came into it again. And this poor, there's one poor kid being described who's in a terrible, terrible situation, crying out to God for help. And Ivan Karamazov says, imagine that you are creating a fabric of human destiny with the object of making men happy in the end, giving them peace and rest at last, but that it was essential and inevitable to torture to death only one tiny creature. That baby beating its breast with its fist, for instance, this one that he was just talking about. And to found that edifice on its unavenged tears, would you consent to be the architect on those conditions? Same question again, Neil. Same question again. Now, the idea of the scapegoat is interesting. We all know what the origins of it as a concept. One goat gets sacrificed, the other goat metaphorically gets all the sins of the community heaped upon it, and then it's sent off to wander in the wilderness, and therefore we're cleansed. In Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, we have one person who has to wear the darkness for everybody else in the shape of their lives being taken. Neil, this story is just echoing something that so many other people, it seems, have struggled with. Why? What? I have one question for you. Why does this possibility, why does this conundrum keep coming up? I mean, what's it based on? There's something deeper here. for me that's really kind of profound. And I'm wondering, is it just that we all realize, because you've already touched on it, we all realize that we're going around and we're living our little lives and we're crying and moaning about this, that and the other, but we realize that in order for us to have these lives, other people are having shit ones, or certainly other people, we're doing the thing of ignoring the fact that other people are having awful times. That's the history of mankind, right? You know, I'm all right, Jack. Is that what's at the heart of this particular question that keeps coming back into the minds of these clever people?
Yeah. And I think universally and through hundreds of years, thousands of years, doesn't matter where you are in the world. If you look at like philosophy from, you know, different cultures, a lot of them all come back to the same idea that you always need balance in the world. So therefore, you can't have happiness without misery. You can't have joy without pain. So I think that's out there established in many philosophical fields that you always need this balance. So I think the question comes up about around this topic in terms of, well, yeah, we all agree with like the physics of balance, the chemistry of balance, the biology of balance. When you get to the morals of balance, we probably agree it needs to exist, but how comfortable do we feel with it? And how comfortable do we feel with that is the natural order of things? So I think it's just there in the human psyche as a question that needs to be asked. Then the second thing is you've got just the absolute reality of it, which you can apply throughout the ages to any big part of life or small part of life. Okay, so for example, I know right now I've got this t-shirt on, right, from a notoriously cheap shop, right, that cost me very little, and that was of a benefit to me. I know deep down, and maybe not even deep down, that this was probably built. This was probably made in some sweatshop somewhere that are employing kids in terribly, terribly dangerous conditions. That is tantamount to slavery. Okay. So, and we probably, everyone listening to this is probably wearing clothes like that now. And we know that, and it's terrible. And we might give money to charities and we might express views, but it doesn't actually stop us them. Well, some people will stop buying those clothes, but there's only so far you can go in, excusing the pun, extrapolating yourself from the fabric of this type of thing, where it's just so interwoven in society that no matter like what you do, there would always be some way in which you're actually still somehow feeding this draconian regime that's going on else somewhere else, or poverty that's going on, or suffering of other people. So I think it just exists in a very real sort of sense. And then you said a really, really good word then in terms of talking about this overall question about it being the architect, about, you know, if you're designing a world, would you agree for it to exist in this way? And I think that's why this question, so this has just come to mind as you were talking, I think that's why this question is so difficult to answer, and therefore if it's difficult to answer, you keep asking the question. Is the much simpler answer is to answer it, if in this hypothetical situation me and you are the architects of what society is going to be like, Trev, and we are asked the question, do you want to set society up in this way? It'll be great, but you'll have someone suffering. At that point, when it doesn't exist, we would say, no, absolutely not. We don't want to set up a society like that. However, society is like that. We're already in it. It's been like that for centuries and thousands of years. And you're caught up in society, and you conform to society and you operate within society. We all do our best just to sort of get through the day, don't we? And a lot of that means just going with the way of the world. And I think, and asking that question when you're actually in it is a much harder moral conundrum when you look at it realistically and say, well, these are the things that I give up. It's just this is just the way of the world, isn't it? You know, would it really matter if I don't buy my t-shirt from this place? I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I'm not actually being a terrible person, Trev. So I think that is an interesting point in terms of, yeah, right at the start before society exists, of course we wouldn't want to set society up like that. But when you're born into it, as we all have been, and that's the way of the world, then all of a sudden it becomes much, much more difficult to answer because it feels nigh on impossible to extrapolate yourself out of it. And it's quite easy to say, oh, well, I can't change anything. What's the difference if I do this? It's not going to change anything. And that's probably how a lot of the people in this story and in this town rationalize it to themselves as well. What can I do?
Can I just sort of double down here and say that in almost an answer to my own question about what is it about people and this bloody idea that they keep trying to rationalize it and keep doing this sum in their head? Are they trying to minimize the suffering and pack it all into one so the greater good, blah, blah, blah? But just something struck me there. I mean, if you think about ancient beliefs and ancient belief structures, in Gnosticism, it's certainly in different types of magic, I think chaos magic, these type of things, you have creatures called archons, right? And archons are, I suppose, the biblical equivalent will be angels. And they're created, I think, by a demiurge, and the biblical equivalent will be God, right? And archons, in this ancient cultural heritage of mankind, old stories that go back millennia, archons feed on suffering and pain and the kind of low vibrational energy of the people on the planet. I mean, right there you have it, you know. Obviously, that's gotten twisted by a lot of people who might be better known in modern terms, who actually believe that these are real creatures and go around, you know, and shape-shifting lizards and all the rest of it. But this idea of the archons and the archonic structure, that goes back thousands of years in culture and folklore and in tradition. And right there you have it. Right there you have this idea of the feeding of the suffering of certain people. So it's as old as the hills as a concept. Now, I do want to talk about the idea of utopia, because this story here talks to us about a society that I suppose we're expected to think is somewhat of an ideal. Certainly Le Guin's narrator has a bit of fun with that. At one stage, I like the part where she sort of pulls up and says, well, maybe you're all thinking this is a little bit goody-goody at this stage. Well, if so, please add an orgy, right? And if this is all too kind of pure for you, why don't you have some and just invents a drug called Druze? Okay, well, let's have Druze, right? And this is all going to go back to my utopia thing later on, because I want to talk to you about Huxley and all that type of thing. But I was very interested because she basically reels you in here. And we become, as we're listening to this discussion and the playful nature of it at the start, right, we sort of get into it. Oh, OK, that's a bit odd. I wish the teenagers and the horses were wearing some clothes. OK, bit odd. The little lad playing the music, I wish his pupils hadn't quite dilated so much and he was actually talking to people or having an ice cream or looking a bit sloppy. Bit odd. But anyway, you know, you're sorry. It's a little bit jarring, but you can see what it is she's trying to do. Then we get into little details about the bit of the crumb of food and the guy's kind of, amiable beard or whatever an amiable beard is. And you're just going, okay, I'm in here. And I think by doing that, we get implicated in the construction of this society. We start to think about ourselves and imagine ourselves in it. And, oh, yeah, that's nice. I like that. And that's what makes it all the more devastating when you realize that's when the hammer blow comes, when you realize, oh, shit, I've been lured in here. And this is what these bastards are enjoying their little summer festival on. This is what all their perfection is built on. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the idea of the narrator or the form and structure, whichever you want to talk about, versus the content of the story. Because I know you have a couple of ideas around that. We might go then to the idea of utopia and we'll see where the conversation takes us after that.
Okay, so it very much starts with the idea of utopia that carries on, but it starts in a more classical sense. And you talk then about biblical references. When you look at this at the beginning and also some references later on, this is very much presented as Adam and Eve's Eden before Eve bites the apple and sin comes into the world. Although there is obviously this one big sin happening that is kept aside. So the whole presentation of it is like this perfect natural landscape. I think there is symbolic meaning in the fact that these kids are frolicking around naked, because that's the whole thing with Adam and Eve as well. You know, there was no shame, there was no guilt, so therefore they roam around naked. It's only when Eve takes a bite of the apple that's where you then see the famous, when people depict it, you know, they've got the leaves over part of their body to hide their shame and hide their guilt. So I do think there is a purposeful biblical inference and reference at the start where it's like, look, this is like Eden before Adam and Eve ballsed it up, essentially.
And would you include the naked frolicking orgy meisters in that as well? Is that sort of a kind of a guileless whatever she calls them, great golden copulations? Is this just sort of a part of the great naivety and innocence and abandonment?
Because that narrator is actually saying, throw in what you want, it's okay. Add what you want. I think there's a couple of little things where it says, oh, don't do this. But that to me comes across as more like comic effect. And I think there is little moments of dark comedy in this, even though it's a horrendous story. That stops actually when we get to the, you know, meeting the child or whatever. But yeah, I think that's part of it. And that's why these things that we think of as sins, you know, like drugs, orgies, all of this type of thing, we say, yeah, that's fine here. Okay, because it actually says, the line is that this town doesn't let guilt inside its walls. And again, that's entirely, you know, if you believe the Old Testament and you believe the Adam and Eve story, whether you believe it actually happened or whether you believe it's something allegorical, the whole idea is that the rest of the humanity forever has carried the burden of their sin and their wrongdoing, and part of that burden is feeling guilt and shame and all of this. In this story, we're being told there is no guilt and no shame here. So again and again, it keeps coming back to this is pre-Adam and Eve Eden. This is utopia. This is absolutely perfect. So you've got all of that going on right from the start. What was the question again? I think I've answered that bit.
You absolutely have. And then I wanted you to just come back to the whole idea, because we spoke a little bit before we went live with the mics, and you said you had something specifically you wanted to do. You've dealt with the narrator part. You said there was something you wanted to do specifically around form versus content, and I wanted to give you an in to do that.
Yeah, that's it, right? Okay, so this is all linked to that stuff. So it was interesting when I was reading the whole bit about, you know, like the naked kids, and this is like innocence, and, you know, this is like a, you know, frivolity and everything. That's clearly supposed to juxtapose with when we come to the abused, neglected child who is naked, but is naked in a very different way, in which, you know, they're literally just sitting around in their own excrements, and they're being mistreated. So we get a clear juxtaposition between, you know, the innocent kids who are naked, and that's demonstrated by the fact that they're naked. When then we go to the very fact that they can be like that, is that you've got this other kid who's abused and neglected. What I think is really interesting as well, and I don't think that this is by accident, there's loads and loads of references to liberty and people being free from shackles. What's really interesting, directly after that bit where they talk about the kids having, you know, being free from the shackles of clothes, you go on about the horse, and the horse, it says the horses wear no gear at all. They've got no bit in their mouth. So even the animals are treated better than this kid. I don't think that is an accident. I think there's like everyone and every creature is free, and that really just heightens the absolute misery and individual hell that this one little kid is living in. And then that got me on to thinking about just the mental torture of that child as well, which is, I don't know why, but I think this is, in some ways, is the most horrible part of the story. You know, the part of the story where it's telling you the environment that the kid lives in, and there's loads of things to be horrified by. But yeah, I thought what was really, really striking image was these mops in the corner that the kid's scared of. Okay.
Yeah.
And that the kid, when the kid closes their eyes, still knows that they're there. Okay. So even just closing their eyes and trying to pretend it's not there doesn't remove the fear, because they know they're there. The second mental torture that the kids got as well is that it wasn't born. So it, I'm doing what the story does. He or she wasn't born into this misery. So you can't even make yourself feel a little bit better by going, well, this is all they've ever known. Because you talk about the kids having memories of like the sunshine and his mum, I think it is, and remembering happy. So this kid is unable to mentally relieve the suffering and the pain that they're in, because they know the context in which it's happening. There's a better world out there that it used to live. And secondly, it knows it can't simply close its eyes and everything be okay, because it's still scared of those mops that's still there. So you've got that image of the kid not being able to make mental decisions to escape. You said then something really, really good about the narrator implicates you into the story. I think what this narrator does, and it might be part of why it's written in this way, is that it showers you with the mental freedoms that this kid hasn't got. Because what this story does, I think it's dead good the way it does it, it's dead interesting, is it says, right, I'm telling you a story about utopia. I'm telling you a story about Eden. This is what it's like. It starts perfectly normal. And then it says, but you know what? You imagine it however you want. You make this work for you. You make this into your utopia, so this feels real to you. And you don't have to follow a fairy tale. What you can do is concoct this world in your mind however you want. So this story just gives you this freedom to think how you want, to create this world and how you want, to make it work for you, which is absolutely diametrically opposed and complete opposite situation that the kid is in, who is unable to escape the horror, even by trying to think of different things. It can't do it. So I think that's a really, I don't think this implicates you in terms of making you, well, I didn't listen to or read it and feel guilty, but it did make me think that as a reader, I'm being afforded the same freedom that the townspeople are, but which the kid isn't.
So you didn't read it and feel guilty, but you probably read it like me and felt outrage and anger, right?
Yeah.
And I know from talking to you and from one of your messages, you're like, what are these people doing? So that's the visceral reaction that you have. So I put it to you then, Neil, at this stage of all our talk about moral conundrums and philosophical problems, is it really, and it just dawns on me here as I'm listening to you, is it actually not that at all? Is it actually just a satire on the concept of utopia, of the ideal society? Is it actually Le Guin telling us that, you know what, it doesn't matter how perfect you make your little world, there will always be a trade-off where some people, in the form here of the suffering child, will be in the worst kind of straits. Is this what it is that, do you think, that our pal Ursula is getting at? So, I mean, the reason I ask is that she herself wrote a satirical novel. Well, I say satirical. It's a satirical look at the concept of utopia. Her one was called The Dispossessed. It was set on a capitalist planet, right, called Urus. And it has an ectopian state satellite called Anaris. Le Guin describes both of them with pathos and realism. And Urus is corrupted by something called propertarianism. But then on Anaris, things aren't great either, because individual creativity is stifled and nothing changes. So again, you've got this situation, well, who really wins? And we're literature, and as a result, since movies are full of this kind of concept. Most famously, we know people like Aldous Huxley, wrote several books, Brave New World, but specifically the a book called Island, which was another one in the in that utopian genre, where again he has a look at a kind of a largely agricultural utopian society. And so what you realize is that this idea, this concept of utopianism, it's tied into so many other sort of philosophies that were popular, especially coming from that late 19th century into the 20th century. Some of them incredibly flawed. Aldous Huxley's own grandfather, T.H. Huxley, was called Darwin's bulldog. He was quite an interesting character. He was very much an exponent of Darwin's theories. And of course, we were all told Darwinism is where it's at. But then there's all these dubious connections between Darwinism and the concept of eugenics. And all of these pseudo-scientific ideas that people swore by as philosophies that became really popular around this era. And I'm wondering, is it that we've got a work of fiction here that's sort of satirizing the whole idea? Like, is utopia possible? Is it really a thing that is just an idea? And is that, do you know, do all these writers know that it's not actually possible? And do all these philosophers like and writers like Dostoevsky know when they're asking this question that you can't have perfection because there always will be suffering? There's always that trade-off. It's just an interesting thing. I'm wondering, have I come full circle around? Have I talked you out of the idea of this actually being a moral conundrum and more of actually a statement? What do you think about that?
I can't confidently say one way or the other. I'm not sure in terms of, has this got a moral? Is the story being told here? And then at the end of it, we're supposed to think, do you know what? For example, we're all striving for perfect lives and utopia, but it's impossible because, you know, shit happens and there's suffering in the world. So is it actually trying to make that point? Or is it simply like a lot of, if it is a philosophical story, I think philosophy, I believe, doesn't tend necessarily to give you answers, but to ask questions. There's a joke, isn't it, that, you know, like sort of to do a philosophy qualification. If anyone ever asks you a question, you just ask the question back. it's just this never-ending circle of asking questions. So I suppose... Actually, you know a bit more about her background. Knowing her background, that would, and the context, and knowing what she brings to this, that would probably get us closer to the answer of, is she trying to tell us a way to think and teach us a lesson, or is she just saying, hey, well, here's a few things to ponder, go away and work it out yourself. Knowing what you know of her and the background, which do, and I'm not just like literally batting it back to you, because I'm not too sure, but that might get us closer to the answer, is sort of knowing her background. So based on that, what do you think?
Well, I reckon the very fact that she's written that utopian novel in 1974, the year after this story comes out, called The Dispossessed, I think that is an interesting part of the package. I think from what I read of her, she was interested in anthropology, cultural anthropology, I think, all sorts of other things as well. She was very much a feminist. She was interested in Taoism, like an awful lot of intellectuals of the time were, and very heavily influenced by Carl Jung, like an awful lot of the intellectuals at the time were and continue to be. You put all those things into your little basket, and I think you are going to look at someone who's trying to adapt the worldview and maybe tell you what is possible and what's not possible, or certainly explore the idea. So you put all that together, and it leads me back to the title. And I'm going to use this to sort of see if we can come to a definitive answer. And honestly, Pooley, I don't care if we do or not, because I've really enjoyed this conversation. And I think we were right at the start. You can't really come to anything definitive here. I thought I was leading myself there, but let me just see if we can get this over the line one way or the other by this idea. The title of the story is The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. And you're always told, as a teacher, I always tell guys to have a look at the title of a poem or a story, because often inherent in that, there will be a central concept which you're supposed to bring with you as you enter the fictional world. So here we are. Why is it that she's focused on those? Why are they the central characters? And when she says at the end about them, just let's focus on what she says about them. So these are the people. They go out into the street. They walk down the street alone. They keep walking and walk straight out of the city of Omelas through the beautiful gates. They keep walking across the farmlands of Omelas. Each one goes alone, youth or girl, man or woman. Night falls. A traveler must pass down village streets between the houses with yellow lit windows and on out into the darkness of the fields. Each alone, they go west or north towards the mountains. They go on. They leave Omelas. They walk ahead into the darkness and they do not come back. The place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the City of Happiness. I cannot describe it at all. It is possible that it does not exist. She's doing it again right there at the end. But they seem to know where they are going, the ones who walk away from Omelas. So bringing it around full circle, are we supposed to focus on these because these are the ones that make the correct decision? These are the ones who opt out of this bullshit deal. And therefore, is that actually the right way of looking at things, that, you know, that kind of trade-off? Is that where the moral lies, that kind of trade-off and being part of that kind of trade-off is absolutely a fool's errand? And then you've got the question of, or do we come back full circle and go, yeah, but they're moral cowards. They've just turned their back in a terrible situation. Oh, man, I think I've confused myself more. What do you think? Why do we focus on them? Why does she focus on them at the beginning and at the end?
Why does she focus on them? I'm not going to answer that question. I'm instead going to just say what came to mind when you were reading it out. Maybe this gets us to that question. Do you know when you were reading that out then? And I never felt this when I read it, but just listened to you read it. That sounds like some serious suicide shenanigans going on the end there to me. You know, when just listening to you reading it out then, the idea of like walking into the darkness and then the whole idea of walking into this unimaginable place, even more unimaginable than the town
that you described.
Idea of like, are they going to kill themselves? They go to heaven, they go to hell.
And maybe it doesn't exist.
Maybe it does exist, maybe it doesn't exist. We all imagine it in different ways. It's difficult to imagine because, you know, obviously nobody knows. So it feels a lot like what it's doing at the end is talking about how there is, it's interesting actually, I was saying that they were walking away from the problem to sort of distance themselves, but it seems to me like they're now in an inescapable level of trauma themselves, or like mental torture, or a sort of an unhappiness they can't get rid of. And I don't know, is she just trying to say we're all doomed to just be unhappy and then we'll... I don't know, Trev. Can we ring her? Ring, is she alive? Or did she walk into the darkness to an unimaginable place? If she's alive, let's get her on and find out what was she barking.
Sadly, Ursula departed our earthly realm in 2018. So we can't just ring her up. But you know what? What she has done is she's given us a very stimulating idea. Several ideas to discuss and a really interesting story to engage with. Again, as with so many of the great stories, your initial feelings of ickiness about certain parts of it get a little bit mollified when you start to discuss the ideas. And that always happens when I have Neil with me to tease these problems out. And this has been another brilliant one. And I've told you that we'll stick to the time, Neil, and we're going to stick to the time. And roughly, anyway, I have you a little bit over the
Trev,
time you allow us.
I reckon, okay, I've come to, right, what she's trying to do.
Ah, here we go.
Okay, she's saying that obviously you can't have happiness without misery, and you can't escape misery. You're either going to have to live in the same town as misery, or if you walk away, you still can't escape misery, and then you're going to go into the darkness. It's a completely nihilistic story. Not only is it satirizing the sense of a utopia, not only is it saying you're not going to have a perfect life, it's saying life is dog shit, and then you die. That's what I reckon it's saying. I don't know, Trev. I'm making it up.
I love that because right at the end there, folks, Neil Poole, you see Harold Shand from the movies, he puts him in the halfpenny place. Carl Jung, Dostoevsky, Le Guin, I've shit him, he says. Remarkable stuff. I really do appreciate that you drew a line under it, man. I appreciate that very much, and I hope everyone has enjoyed this episode. Like I say, it's always a delight to do these shows with Neil. Hopefully we'll be back to you soon with another one. Regardless of whether it will be me or Neil, there will be another one in December as promised. If it's a story only, so be it. If it's the two of us back again, better again. But one way or the other, there will be more great stories with you. We have great plans for 2022. And do please consider doing all the things you can do to keep the show going, whether it be to donate on a one-off basis, to become a subscriber producer of the show. All of you wonderful people are massively appreciated keeping the lights on here, quite literally, or to just at least go and spread the word amongst your nearest and dearest. I'd appreciate that very much. So once again, thanks a million to Neil Poole, and we will talk to you all again very soon.